This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Alberto Oranger. How are you, Alberto?
I'm great, Chris. Thank you. Thank you for having me again.
Not a problem, mate. We had you here last week and we were talking about China. I want to continue talking about China. And actually, as we left last week, we were just starting to talk about the e-commerce market in China, which I'm quite interested to talk a wee bit about. But what I forgot to do last week was really talk a little bit about yourself. You did mention you work for Marchese Frescobaldi, but I didn't really explore that too much. And I know I've read your bio and it talks about your mum being from Verona and your dad from Piemonte, but I don't think you're in the wine trade back then, were you?
No, not at all, not at all. You know, in my bio, that's just a polite way to hide the fact that I have no connection whatsoever to the wine world.
That's what that's the way I read it as well.
As far as my family goes, there is no winemakers, there is no winery, there is no Marchese for sure. So I come from a very rural part of Italy, which is northwestern Piemonte. Mm-hmm. Very tiny, teeny tiny town, 300 of us. So everybody knows each other. And my dream had always been to be, to just escape.
I was going to say, everybody from a small town just wants to escape. And then people from big cities just want to go there.
Yeah, when you retire, right? Yeah. So China was the perfect plan. Because back then when I just finished my high school, there were very few institutions providing training in Chinese studies, and I had a great experience. I went to Venice University, so did my 3 years BA studying and living on the island, which was very romantic and really, really an intense experience. And then I finished my degree and I moved to London for a very brief time, started working in the F&B, and then I ended up in Shanghai because I was doing my master's there. And my plan was to stay for 6 months, and I ended up staying in Shanghai for 7 years. So I joined a boutique consulting firm focusing on market entry in China, so helping out companies in a very diverse range of industries such as fashion, automotive, media, FMCG. And I ended up doing a project on wines, which was so fun. I thought, why not trying to make a career out of this? So I was lucky enough to come across a Veneto producer called Sartori from Verona.
Oh, yeah.
They were looking for somebody to represent them as brand ambassador in China at that time. They had just started a big project with a state-owned enterprise in that market, and I was assigned to cover that post. So I started back in 2010, and I stayed with them for 9 years, building Asian markets. And in March 2020, I had the wonderful privilege to join the Frescobaldi family as their head of APAC markets.
So Frescobaldi there in Tuscany?
They are in Tuscany. They are one of the oldest families in winemaking.
What do they do? Are they in Chianti or are they?
They are everywhere. So the key message is really diversity, cultivating Toscana diversity. So we have 9 different estates across the region, and we go from cool climate, high altitude Chardonnay, all the way down to big and bold red wines from Maremma, the warmest region in Tuscany, going through Chianti, Chianti Classico, and Montalcino. So it's really pretty much everything that counts in Tuscany. Yeah.
Cool. Okay, so last week we were talking about where people buy and sell wines, and we were talking a little bit about you were saying that the online market is actually quite one of the largest online largest online market in the world for wine.
Yeah.
But one of the things you finished up with it was a classic problem you get in the UK as well, where you get two channels, and if you're in the restaurant trade, the last thing you want to be selling is your £10 bottle of wine that you're retailing for 50 and find that some other bugger is selling it for £15 somewhere, and all of a sudden there's that price transparency. When you've got big markups, it's quite hard to sort of hide that. So in the UK, for example, we often find that wines are segmented down one of the two channels. You either go down the retail market, the major multiples, supermarkets, big chain wine stores, that type of thing, or you go down the sort of small independent / restaurant market as well. And in China, it seems that they don't quite have that sort of separation in markets. And you seem to think that the online market was quite a problematic for retailers. Do you want to just recap on what you were saying there?
Sure. Yeah. In China, there is no legislation whatsoever as far as to what sort of channel you can sell to. Mm-hmm. So if you're an importer based in Shanghai, you can sell your wine to a restaurant in Shanghai. You can sell it to a wine shop in Beijing. You can sell it to a e-commerce platform, which will then be capable to deliver a case of wine virtually anywhere in China. And so there is an ongoing process of integration of different channels, which is happening, to many, many importers. And what is one of the key challenges is to integrate your e-commerce into your pricing strategy for the other channels. So, e-commerce is super transparent. If you have your, let's say, restaurant wine ending up in a e-commerce platform at the wrong price, even though it's just a matter of, two, three bottles being available on a website, it may damage your reputation in the trade, especially. It's more than a consumer level. It's more of a trade problem. When wholesalers or retailers see that, they will challenge you. They will challenge your price system, and they will challenge not only that wine's price system, but also your whole portfolio. So this is an aspect which is often not really so well understood by wineries and brand owners. And I certainly think there should be more research and more awareness to this problem, because it is really causing many, many importers troubles. Once your price drops in that channel, it's very, very hard to go back to where you were. It takes, months or years in some cases. So that's quite an important factor when you think about your pricing strategy in China.
Do you have wines deciding that they just want to sell e-commerce and they go purely down the e-commerce? Do you get people making up brands, some Australian critter,
sure,
just to be sold down the e-commerce channel? And do you get, like, over here you might get a producer and he'll have the same wine, same tank, half it gets labeled with one label, half it gets labeled with another, one goes down the major multiples, one goes down the small independents, and no one knows that they're the same apart from the guy who bottled them, really.
Yeah. All of these at the same time happen in the market. It's the clever ways really to create a differentiation among what goes into different channels. So if you have the flexibility as a producer to place different labels, in different channels in China, then it's certainly a plus, but then the reality of things is that China being quite a secondary market, in terms of the volume and the amount of business that it generates for most brands, sometimes it's not really worth to go all the way to create a new line for the Chinese e-commerce, that's unless you really have big plans for that specific channel. So very often, it just happens that, the same label that you're selling, which is your flagship wine, in the wholesale market, ends up by parallel trade or by some other ways into e-commerce, and that creates a lot of confusion. So I think, really owning your value chain, owning your distribution, it's very important, and it's something that very, very few brand owners have been trying to pursue in China. Those who have not the capability or the resources to have somebody on the market or to really coordinate well with their importers to make sure that that the importers is are looking after this aspect. And sometimes it's just sheer lack of knowledge about the market. So you there's so many wineries that don't really know the market that well, and they just end up selling their wine to people that show up at the winery. They say, okay, we're just going to do a couple of pallets or a container of that, and they have absolutely no idea where the wine is going to end up. So it's I always recommend producers to do their due diligence, and making some deep research and analysis before moving forward in their commercial decisions.
What's the markups like in China? If we look at, say, the UK system, a retailer in the UK would normally make maybe 35% markup, plus or minus 5%, sometimes at 30, sometimes at 40. But, it's around 35% is sort of markup for a retailer. Restaurants, obviously, is more like 300%, or depending on the level of service, anywhere from 200 to 500. But what's the markups for, say, the e-commerce channel? Is there a typical markup for that, or
there isn't? So this is really what is quite disruptive. According to your e-commerce route to market, you may end up in very different positions. So and how you sell into e-commerce? I mean, it must be through an importer. Sometimes the e-commerce platforms will integrate an import company, so they will have their own direct import. And this is really tricky, where it gets really tricky, because, in that case, they control the supply. They can basically skip one layer, and they will certainly end up undercutting other players who have the same items available. Mm-hmm. And they may take even just sometimes 10-15% margin on whatever they're selling, which is obviously not beneficial to your brand, to your product across the other channels. In terms of markups, classic distribution, if you take on-premise, is really not too dissimilar to what you described just now. So if you go to marketplaces such as Shanghai or Beijing, 3 to 4 times for, a fine dining establishment. It can be 2.5 times for a casual dining. Mm-hmm. Sort of environment. And then on the retailers, it really boils down to how much volume they're selling. So you have high level retailers, and I can give you an example. For example, it's one of the best gourmet supermarkets in China. It's called Olé. So Olé, it's beautiful selection from all over the world. Everything you can possibly think of, will be there in terms of imported goods, not only wines, but also food. Their markups, their margins tend to be higher compared to mass market supermarkets such as, Walmart, for example, mm-hmm. who has operations in China, or the local chains, as RT Mart or Vanguard. These are a few of the names that are there. And then it really depends on the player you're talking to. Some of them are going for a differentiation and upselling strategy. Some others are going for sheer volumes. So their interest is just to move and rotate fast whatever is on the floor.
Yeah.
And then very often, they their model is also squeezing whatever they can out of their local suppliers. So doing business with a supermarket, hypermarket in China is very expensive. You do have to cater for their every need, which includes not only the product, but also, buying the space, buying promotional slots, making sure that you have promoters on the ground and paying for that. So that's very expensive. And it goes, well beyond your cost of goods sold.
Okay. Sounds very much like the supermarkets here, to be honest, except maybe not the promoters on the ground. Yeah. Let's have a little chat about Australia, because You mentioned earlier, you mentioned last week about Penfolds being the big brand. That was the brand that you see in second or third tier cities that people understood what was going on. But then the Australians made a terrible mistake. They actually wanted transparency and things like that from the Chinese government, which is clearly not going to, doesn't go down well with the Chinese government, you know, being taken to task on something. Whatever the reason was for why the Aussie, the Chinese did it, Australia was a huge supplier. I think they were their number one supplier of wine.
By volume, they were the number one just before the sanctions happened.
And then bang, done. Thank you. They got something like 200-300% tariffs added to them for calling out for transparency and an investigation into COVID, which is clearly a ridiculous thing to call for. They lost their, well, I think they lost their market. I've seen some statistics that show that the sales in Australia just went through the floorboards. But it was that a function of the tax cost, or is it a function of the fact that the Chinese decided that actually Australia was not the brand for them, and they wanted to support other countries that weren't giving them a hard time? You know, was it a taxation issue? Is it a price thing, or is it a culture or a nationalistic thing, really?
Both, actually. So the reason is political. So the why this happened, you know, it's, you know, what you just described. So it's really a political struggle between the two governments. And, you know, China is not the sort of country, that, not the sort of government that will be strong arm into doing something, you know, unwillingly. So they took it bad, and as a way to retaliate against this, you know, they imposed this really punitive tariff duty on Australian wines, which is going to stay for at least 5 years. You know, this is what they officially say. And as you can see by the stats here, you know, this is going to, you know, Australia went from number two in terms of value, just after France, to bottom of the chart. So they lost 85% in last year.
Yeah.
Of whatever it was imported in the country, and there was huge, and it was really because Australian wines have become too expensive and unprofitable. At the same time, there's also another reason. I think, you know, the reason why Australian wines were extremely popular and extremely well received was also a sort of tactic that some part of the trade and the market will had put in place. So the Australian government was running an investment visa sort of program, whereby investing a certain amount of money in agricultural foods from their country, you will be able to be granted, you know, a eligibility for Australian citizenship sooner than, you know, some other standard avenue. So a lot of importers were putting together big wealthy buyers to invest in huge sums of funds, you know, to purchase estates or to purchase wines from Australia. But, you know, very often it was land, so estates, and what do you do? Okay, we're just going to make wine out of it. We ship it to China, we pay it, you know, we make it, so it's a way for us to get our money out of the country, which is not that easy in China.
Yeah.
You know, there's very strict legislation. And that helped to create a bubble in the market. So it was not only the import numbers that you saw in the China stats for Australian wines were certainly, you know, to some degree that wine was being consumed. To some other degree, it was just filling warehouses somewhere in China. But it was really just a sort of investment scheme that very, you know, wealthy, influential buyers were used to do. And it's no surprise that so many of the brands that you will see on the market, Australian wines, you will never really see those brands anywhere else. It was just, as the Chinese call it, OEM wine. So, which is a very, it's a ruthless way to describe it. But it's really what it is. It's private labels that were just designed to this specific purpose.
So the Chinese were investing in Australian viticulture. Mm-hmm.
Viticulture, correct.
As a way of getting cash out of China.
Yeah, that was part of the scheme. And obviously, you know, they were also trying to resell those wines, but it was not easy, you know. So that has created some speculation and about Australian wines, you know, in that market. Mm-hmm. This is just to say that not everything that was imported in China was being consumed. So, but no, even that being said, you know, I think Wine of Australia especially had done an amazing job in terms of promoting their country and their wines. And, you know, there have been instances of, you know, not only the largest brands, the largest brand owners in Australia have become really successful in China, and but also some medium size or even small size brands that have become quite you know, well received in the Chinese market. So I think it was a mixed batch of things, but you know, certainly with these punitive tariffs, you know, it's really not worth to invest certainly in Australian viticulture. Whether this is for an investment or for reselling, you know, even for the classic traditional brands, you know, this has become a much different market compared to what it was 2 years ago. And, you know, if you buy a bottle of wine off a supermarket shelf, you know, like, you know, the daily drinking varietal, straight varietal, yellowtail or similar, it would be way more expensive now compared to 3-4 years ago. So they've lost a lot of the consumption they had.
I suppose all that wine that was imported that was just sitting in warehouses.
Yeah, waiting to be dispatched somewhere.
Yeah, I imagine that wine's been churned through now, but who's replaced all that wine that was being imported by Australia?
Nobody really. So if you look at the stats, you can see that Chile has resurged. Chilean wines have been quite popular in China for a while. You know, they have, you know, similar to some other newer players, you know, they are quite flexible in terms of what they do with their own production, you know, way more flexible than European wineries. Mm-hmm. So the Chinese like it because, you know, very often Chinese importers or even wholesalers or retailers will love to have their own exclusive label.
Yeah.
So the Chilean have been pretty good in tapping into that market. And then you had Italy and Spain taking some of that market share, but not much really. Neither Italy nor Spain have really been able to crack the market. And then, you know, I think probably France, French wines were those that most benefited. Because, you know, they've been the strongest, not only in China, but in Asia for ever since wine industry exists in mm-hmm. that part of the world. So the French have been really, really good in terms of the structured job they're doing on a daily basis to promote their wines on the floor, on the ground, through trade seminars, events, to consumers. And there is this perception at a consumer level that the French wine, and especially those from Burgundy and Bordeaux, are, you know, the best bang you get out of your buck.
So, really?
So of course, you know, if you're a Chinese businessman, which is, you know, a typical wine, I would say, consumer, if we were to try and segment, you know, Chinese wine consumer, it's a very difficult task, but, you know, certainly corporate and, you know, business, entertainment, consumption, it's a key part of the market. Then, you know, if you go to a restaurant, you treat your customer to a nice bottle of Bordeaux.
Yeah.
Or, you know, most recently, it's been Burgundy. So that's what really takes in China.
Brilliant. Okay then, Alberto, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris. It's been great to be on the podcast, and I hope to come across each other again very soon.
Cool. Always nice to talk to a fan of the podcast. Yes, cheers. You made the mistake of telling me you'd listened to it before. Yeah.